Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted that Bremont will be sponsoring the Money Maze podcast throughout this year. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont. Fidelity is a 15th century French word for faithfulness. Anglicized to fidelity, it became the name for a new investment business in 1946 by its founder, Edward Johnson. Today, Fidelity Investments is one of the largest asset managers in the world, with $3.3 trillion in assets under management, 50,000 global employees, and over $20 billion in revenue. And unusually, the company remains private, and family and employees still own over half of the equity. And today we're extremely lucky to have the chief executive of its international business, Fidelity International, Anne Richards. Fidelity International was established in 1969 and became independent of the US organization in 1980. So Anne, a very warm welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Well, you are fourth Scott to come on the Money Maze podcast. We had Neil Ferguson, Davy Arrow, Martin Gilbert, and I think you were educated in Edinburgh. I'd love to hear a little bit about that early journey.
So I am indeed born and bred in Edinburgh. My dad's a Glaswegian. My mum was very much from Edinburgh, both very, very working class backgrounds. And they had an interesting journey because my parents both benefited from what we would probably today call a widening participation agenda, which happened right after the end of the Second World War. And so my parents, from those very working class roots, managed to get themselves law degrees by working during the day in the civil service and studying for the law in the evening. And that combination of hard work, pulling yourselves up by your bootstraps, really needing to be independent, very much, I think, coloured our upbringing as children and imbued in us that real focus on making sure that you are the master of your own destiny and work hard and you'll get where you need to get to.
So you study after, I think, Royal High School in Edinburgh. You go to Edinburgh University to study electronics and electrical engineering. Now, that might be a first for us. Tell me a little bit about what was the motivation.
So I went to, as you say, the Royal High School, which was a fantastic school. It's, I think, one of the oldest schools, certainly in Europe, possibly even in the world, in terms of its roots. It goes all the way back to the 11th century or something. But it was very much comprehensive. And I think I was part of the third or fourth year of girls that were able to join what was historically a boys-only school. And so we came in, and my strongest subject at school unquestionably was maths. And I was, first of all, thought maybe science, medicine, but kind of figured out that really wasn't my thing. And then I thought maths kind of interested me. And then I had a light bulb moment, had a wonderful physics teacher called Mr. Davison, who I'm still very much in touch with. He's lovely, just lives up the road from where my father still is today. He said to me, Anne, you know, the thing you really love doing is solving problems. And if you're wondering about what to study at university, why don't you think about engineering? Because that's basically solving problems. It was a light bulb moment, if that's not too much of a pun, because I thought, yeah, that's what I really want to do. And so I went and I studied engineering, possibly without realizing maybe that it was a relatively unusual thing for girls to be doing at that time. There were about 10% of our class were girls, but it was really down to that light bulb moment with my physics teacher at school that set me on that path.
Well, we might talk later on about an engineering perspective in a world where technology is changing so much of what we do, but that didn't necessarily set you up for finance. So what happened as you came through graduation?
When I was still a student, I went to work for a summer at CERN in Geneva, so the European Laboratory for Particle Physics, and loved it. And partly that was because my father had been sent to Switzerland as a very young man when he developed tuberculosis and had spent 6 months there. So we had a family love affair with Switzerland that went back really a long way. So it was a very natural step for me to want to go to Switzerland. And then after I graduated, CERN offered me a research fellowship. So I really felt I was on a path, an academic track, if you like. I thought I was heading for a career in research in academia, that it would lead to a doctorate. And I adored CERN. I loved CERN. I'm still very involved with CERN. I helped set up their charitable foundation a few years ago. I still think it's an absolutely marvelous place. But I gradually began to realize that I was surrounded by people who had this absolute focus on the mission of CERN to find what we now actually know as the Higgs boson. And I didn't have that same passion. And so there was a moment again where I realized that I wasn't doing enough of what I really felt got me up in the morning. And I certainly didn't have quite that level of passion that I could see around me. So I started to sort of seek out more of what I needed. And it was more of a commercial aspect to life. It was unquestionably something where perhaps a single-minded focus wasn't quite what drove me, but was I wanted more different things. You know, I'm a multitasker. I like multitasking.
And so I know you've worked at Mercury, Edinburgh Fund Management at Aberdeen on your journey, but did you find the attraction in the analysis or in the understanding of the broader business?
The journey was that I left CERN and went to work for a technology consultancy. And after a couple of years of running projects and technology and engineering space, I realized I needed more management skills. So I went back to the continent. I went to INSEAD, just outside Paris in Fontainebleau, to study for an MBA. And that's when I came across financial markets. And that's when I fell in love with what I've often described as a kaleidoscope, that every day you shake the kaleidoscope and the pieces may be the same, but the pattern's totally different. And that level of stimulation, I've just found immensely exciting all through my career. I've never lost that amazement. Every morning, it's the first thing I do is flip on the screen and just see what's happened. So I love that aspect of it. But I had no idea of how financial markets worked. I had no idea of the different sorts of businesses. I didn't know what the difference between an investment manager and an investment bank was. I had no family background, no friends in this world. It was alien to me. So when I started interviewing, when I graduated looking for a job, I had really no more sophisticated an idea that I wanted somehow to work in financial markets. And I thought, well, I could always go back to engineering if it doesn't work out. But this is my chance to try that. And so when you've got an engineering background, the natural thing is for people to look at you as a prospective engineering analyst. And that's what I did. And actually, the presentation on campus that got me to think about fund management was Fidelity. And I was devastated when they didn't hire me as an analyst. So I joke, it took me almost 30 years to get hired by Fidelity, but I got there in the end. Just shows you perseverance counts. But more seriously, that was my first way in, because I knew the engineering sector, I knew the engineering world, and I had got my MBA, which gave me the toolkit for investment analysis, for financial analysis. And I think if you're changing career, if you're changing industry, you need to be able to bring something that has some relevance to what it is that people want you to do in this new world. And that was my first way in fact, and how I got into the industry in the first place.
I should say that waiting 30 years to get the top job is okay.
I was really pleased to get that call, I got to say.
Fantastic. You spend time at Aberdeen. Martin Gilbert, who came on the show very kindly, suggested that you also come on the show. Edinburgh Fund Managers gets absorbed by Aberdeen, changing culture. You remain the CIO. How difficult was it to bring these cultures together?
Rewinding ever so slightly further back, I had gone to Edinburgh Fund Managers, aware of the fact that it had some challenges. I was working at that time, I was running the Alpha team at what had been Mercury Asset Management, which became Merrill Lynch Investment Management, as that gradually got absorbed together. And of course, has subsequently been absorbed by BlackRock. But the chance to move to a much smaller firm, but nonetheless have my arms around the entirety of the investment world as CIO was really appealing. So I had gone up to Edinburgh Fund Managers, understanding that it was a small listed company in the middle of what was a pretty intense bear market, if you think back to what 2002 was like. And when I went in September 2002, we had very, very quickly, within a matter of weeks, a shareholder revolt, which ultimately resulted in us losing not only our chief executive, but the entirety of our non-executive directors on the board, leaving essentially myself and the chief operating officer as the sole representatives. And I was appointed managing director at that point in time. And it became really clear that through that, we weren't going to be able to continue as a standalone business through that bear market. So we started thinking about what we could do. And we got introduced to Aberdeen, and it became apparent that there was some real strengths that between the two of us as businesses that we could really add two and two together and get a little bit more than four. So we agreed to sell the business to Aberdeen. And I thought at that stage that I would probably just stay for a year and then move on, just bed the clients down, get everything settled and move on. And I was there for 13, 14 years, I think. Now, the cultural aspect was different in many respects. Edinburgh Fund Managers was possibly a little bit more patrician in a way, a little bit more establishment perhaps rather than patrician, whereas Aberdeen at that time was very much, you know, Martin had started it, had run into some challenges, but it had a hunger, it had a kind of urgency about it. And actually, we brought those businesses together, and quite a number of the key players that went on to work through that subsequent period of recovery and then really strong growth that Aberdeen had, I think came because Martin was always brilliant about figuring out where the people were in any business he acquired that would help bring closer together the business that had been acquired and get the best out of that business. And he really was terrific. If you looked at our group management board, you would see that the majority of people on it had come through an acquisition, had chosen to stay. And so we avoided an awful lot of that tension that you often get in unsuccessful M&A at a people level. That was our journey. And, you know, Martin is at times challenging, but always interesting, always a positive energy source in working with them. And he was great fun to work with. We had a fantastic time, got to say.
He did want me to ask the question of what you thought of him as a boss.
Well, listen, the thing about Martin as a boss is you learn this very quickly. Your email has to be short. Make sure it can be answered, yes or no. And never, ever make the mistake of putting two questions in one email, because you'll get a single word answer, yes or no, but you'll never know which question it was answering. So, you know, you learned with Martin. You learned with Martin. He was great fun.
So you become chief executive then of M&G, which was your stop before Fidelity. Was there a particular lesson you took from that?
Fantastic company, M&G. And I had known M&G, had known some of the characters within M&G because they had been big shareholders in Aberdeen and actually Edinburgh Fund Managers at different moments in time. Being a subsidiary of an insurance company was really quite challenging. And I'd never worked in the insurance sector before. And I found that aspect of it, I think, more difficult than I anticipated. I think the mentality in the insurance world is obviously very much about the downside, because that's what insurance is all about. Whereas the mentality in an investment management business is very much about thinking about the upside. Of course, you have to control the downside, but it's a positive return seeking world, which is a little bit different from the mentality with an insurance company. And I just think that tension can make a little more challenging for asset management companies owned by insurers than it is for those that are not owned by insurers. And I didn't expect that going into it. So, I think that was the one thing. There is a difference there. And it's something that you have to work to overcome as a subsidiary.
So you take on this job as chief executive of Fidelity International. And I guess starting at a high level, how would you describe the mission?
We don't talk in terms of mission. We talk in terms of purpose. We think of our purpose as being helping people to build better financial futures. That's ultimately what our purpose is. And we're somewhat unique, I think, in terms of our footprint, because we have a very wide geographic footprint. And of course, lots of asset managers do, but we're in well over 25 countries. So, I mean, it's a broad geographic spread. But I think even more than that, we're a mixture of both a business to business asset management business, so a classic institutional and wholesale business, as well as a direct-to-customer business, because we have our private investor business. We have our DC pension fund business as well, our workplace investing business. And so we've got both a kind of facing off to institutional side to what we do and what we create, but also we have that engagement. We've got 2.5 million direct customers who come to us every day. That's a blend that we always think about. You know, when we talk about building better financial futures for people, it's either directly with those 2.5 million end customers, or it's working with our partners who could be defined benefit pension schemes, could be defined contribution pension schemes. It could be through private banks or retail banks and other wholesale channels. And so we've got that very broad footprint. And of all the businesses I've ever worked for, Fidelity International definitely has that broadest mix of business lines and routes to market, which means it's complex. It's unquestionably a complex business.
There is a tendency when one sits in the UK or Europe, I think the populations were up 440 million people in the EU, 500 when you add the UK, and a more mature investing profile generally, and probably less transaction, more discretionary bias. And then we've got Asia with nearly 4.5 billion people and an extraordinary opportunity. How do each of those geographies think about investing, and how do you think about your time allocation?
Yeah, really good question. More than half of our employees are in Asia across the different markets within Asia. So I mean, we have a very Asian focused business. And although historically more of our flows have tended to come from Europe in general, you can see that the weight is gradually shifting. So versus where we were 5, 6, 7 years ago, you can see that the importance of Asia in that overall mix, it becomes increasingly balanced over time. The historic view has been that Asian investors were more transactional, were more trading oriented. I think there's still some truth in that, but the markets themselves vary enormously. So Korea is very different to Japan, is very different to Hong Kong, is very different to Singapore. And the markets are each developing their own cadence and their own demand. What we can see is that some things which might have had more of an importance historically in Europe, sustainability would be one example, are really beginning to get traction now in the different Asian markets. And the search for yield, the need for income, again, you can really see that's beginning to get traction across Asia. So there are very much common themes, I think, emerging, although where each country is in that cycle, I think, varies, as you would anticipate. Each market's very different.
The two big population masses are clearly China and India, and I think you're applying for an AMC in China. Tell me a little bit, first of all, with China, how difficult it is.
We've been in China for many years. We've had on-site presence in China. We were the first foreign company who were awarded a WFI license, I think, back in 2017. We've got great operational capability in China. And our experience in China over the last 15 plus years has been one of slow, patient growth, which I think has paid off. And you've really seen the capability, the technology, the investment opportunities in China grow enormously over that period of time. I think the macro view within China, which I think is interesting for us when you think about our overall footprint, is that the needs of the population in China to that better financial health, to helping towards a savings, a healthy savings environment, they're absolutely the same as we see in other markets around the world. There's no government around the world is not wrestling with how do you provide good retirement frameworks to allow the second and the third pillar, so both the corporate and the individual savings for pensions, savings for retirement, really to make sure that people can then avoid poverty in old age. So we see the same trends emerging in China, although they're very much still in the development phase of that. And I think that's for us the appeal. It's the reason why we applied for a China AMC license, which is because we see the need of the wider population in China to get a really good mutual fund structure going in order to be able to save for that long-term retirement. And we take the same approach that we've done for many, many years. We'll go at it slowly and patiently and make sure that we try and build right from the outset. So that's our thinking around China.
And is India a very different proposition?
India is a very, very different market, very different in a number of different respects. We don't have a direct fund management license in India. We have a lot of fantastic technology capability in India. We have a lot of fantastic operational capability in India. But we think the fund management market still has proven to be a difficult place for foreign asset managers really to get traction in. And it's one that we continue to watch and work with, and we work with a number of partners there. But we see that probably needing to mature a bit more before it's a market which really feels like it's a market we can service well directly. So it's a market for us that probably through partnership is still the way to go for now. But in terms of the skills and the capabilities that we've got with our team in India, and we've got great research analysts as well as a technology and operations support there, we continue to see that as a fantastic source of talent for the organization.
So I'd like to talk about this intersection between client interaction and technology. I read that, correct me if I'm wrong, that you mentioned clients of today are wanting more investment interaction. And I wonder if you can just explain that, first of all.
If you look at how we've all changed in the way that we engage in technology, even those of us of a certain age, I mean, we're all far more technologically literate than we were even 5 years ago. And I think probably the pandemic has accelerated this for many people. We have just got used to doing things online and on a computer, or even more so on our phone, over the last few years and certainly over the last few months, because we've had to. And that now extends to the way we engage with financial services as an industry. And so I think people want more and better access and more flexibility to look at things in the way that they want to look at them through that kind of interface. But I think what's interesting is that the research also shows that although people want to be able to do much more and much more flexibly with a digital interface, when it comes to actually pulling the trigger on a big financial decision, most people still want to speak to a real person before they do that. And so for us, it's interesting is how you can create models that have that hybrid mix of human interaction at the point where it's really needed and valued, but actually don't force people to have that interaction until that point, and to try and get that balance right. Now, there'll always be a few early adopters who actually don't care and just are completely happy with an entirely digital interaction. It is a subset. The majority of people still, for the big decisions in their lives, really want to know that there's a person at the end of the phone that they can trust, that they can say, is this the right thing to do? Or just tell me I'm not being stupid and doing it. And I think that's interesting to try and figure out how you make that hybrid model really effective and work absolutely seamlessly. And I wouldn't say we've got perfection there yet, but it's very much the direction of travel that we're working on.
But doesn't it ultimately have to be, put crudely, a numbers game? Because if you've got a high net worth segment, which you do, there are aspirations there to have that dialogue. But if you're in the recognizing the importance of fintech and you're in the retail market, it needs to be solved technologically.
We are moving from an analog world to a digital world in terms of the way we think, or we need to think as an industry about our production capability. And we've not historically thought as well we should about, first of all, about the data layer. Our data is held typically in segmented buckets that make it very, very difficult to manipulate, to give customers the answers to questions that we want. So there's a whole piece around how we treat our data as an asset and how we think of ourselves as data firms, first and foremost. And then there's the whole piece around the operation and the technology that you need to support that. And that is, as you said, that's a numbers game. It's about thinking how you drive down your unit cost of manufacturing to, if you were starting today, what is it that you would do? What should the unit cost of manufacturing be? And if you can do that, that then allows you to layer on top of that the service levels that you need to be able to offer profitably good product to the mass market at the same time as you're offering a really high service, high touch, high value add service to the high net worth end. And having the right foundational base gives you the flexibility to do that. But we've not often enough thought in terms of unit manufacturing cost as an industry, because we've tended to allow markets to lift us. And through that, rising markets allowed that to mask the fact that we've got pretty inefficient manufacturing bases underpinning what we do. I think that's the journey that the investment management industry is on. It's how it revolutionizes itself to think about itself as a technology-based firm with human service levels on top.
And are you glad you're armed with an engineering degree as you take this on?
Yeah, I'm glad I am. I'm not entirely sure that my ops and tech teams always think in the same way. But I think it helps.
I'd like to talk about age, demographics and sex. Gloria Steinem said, I've yet to hear a man ask for advice on how to combine marriage and a career. And I suspect that that reluctance often extends to the default position of men in finance. But you've noted that there is a shift going on and that women are increasingly in charge of household budgets. I'm really intrigued about this.
It's really interesting because if you look back, you know, I've been reading some stuff on this in the last few days just by coincidence. Women have always had far more purchasing power than perhaps has been economically recognized. You know, and I think that's just been ignored for quite a long period of time. When it comes to investment decisions, you've got more women-headed households. Women are over time, I think, increasingly realizing they have to become more financially literate. And we need to do better as an industry about speaking in a language that doesn't turn them off rather than get them engaged in how to make appropriate financial decisions. Because when you are uncomfortable with the language that's being used, where you don't feel that it's speaking to you, it is more likely to make you inappropriately risk averse. And we know that being out of the market, you know, that cash can be a really risky place to put your money over the long term if it's not enough to meet what your ultimate long-term liabilities are. And that's a complicated message to try and get across. So I think one of the really important things for our industry, and it's not unique to the messaging that we need to do for women, but I think it particularly speaks to women, is to turn us away from a mindset of fearfulness about investing, fearfulness about finance, and to think about, you know, how you create a healthy savings culture, what a healthy savings P&L looks like in a family sense, and how we encourage people to engage with that and to be confident enough to ask the right questions in order to get the right answers, which are more likely to move them to that financial goal. And that's what we would love to try and do as a firm, we'd love to try and do as an industry, is to move us more in that direction.
So that crosses over into the whole area of culture and building a firm. And you've said that the people you want to hire need to be brave, bold, curious, and compassionate. Tell me a little bit about how you and your senior leaders think about that hiring process.
So let me talk a little bit about the behaviours that you identified, because we did a piece of work not long after I came in. I said, look, I want to just assess where we are on thinking about what our values and behaviours are, because I think you have to be quite explicit to people about what the expectations of the firm are on you, how we expect you to interact with customers, how we expect you to interact with each other as colleagues, how we expect you to look after each other as colleagues. We did a piece of work, lots of focus groups, and those words that emerged were words that came out of the organization, brave and bold, curious and compassionate, that encompassed lots of different subwords, but encompassed the feeling of that's what we wanted to aspire to be. You know, we wanted to push ourselves forward. We wanted to challenge ourselves. We were curious. We needed to be braver sometimes. We needed to be tougher on ourselves sometimes, but we needed to do it with kindness in the workplace. We needed to put ourselves and walk in our customers' shoes. So that was what we set ourselves. And it is an aspiration. I can't say that everything I do every day is brave and bold and curious and compassionate. I'm sure we all fail every day at them, but at least it's a standard that, you know, you're aspiring to work towards. And I think that helps. I think that gives you something to anchor on. So when we are looking in our recruitment processes, we are looking for people that we don't necessarily say everyone has to be brave and bold. It's not necessary that everyone is in that space the whole time. But nonetheless, people who can see why that is a good aspiration to have and how that can fit in with their own uniqueness as people. And so we're trying to capture the uniqueness of people, but at the same time, anchor them on these are the expectations of you. That's what we think about with our internal teams and with when we're trying to attract into the business as well.
Well, I wanted to talk about ESG, but you've actually quite nicely talked specifically to the S and G in the culture that you're really trying to establish. I had a conversation with a gentleman called Ravi Bulshandani, who's a former Wall Street economist and lectures at Imperial. And he said, how can you persuade clients that when it comes to ESG, you're really doing things differently?
We take two lenses on this. The first is that our mandate is to look after other people's money and look after that money for the long term. That is the mandate that we are given. And it's true in both our direct-to-customer businesses and in our institutional and wholesale businesses. It's very much, we are custodians of other people's money. We are stewards of their money. And therefore, we have a responsibility to try and consider all of the things that might affect the investments that we make. And you can see through 2020, this really accelerated, that the focus on those things that we encompass into the ESG matrix, into that ESG phraseology, if you like, and terminology, are things, when you look at, for example, the environment, that not looking after the environment today unquestionably has a cost tomorrow. And at the moment, that cost doesn't directly find its way into financial accounts. But through the perspective of a long-term investor, that cost ultimately will come through. The fact that it's not a financial impact today doesn't mean that it won't be a financial impact tomorrow. And as you've seen this acceleration through 2020 with all the weird stuff that happened in 2020, our own analysis of our own ESG ratings, and we rate every single company that we follow across our investment universe, 3,000 odd, we have our own proprietary ratings, they're forward looking. We had a very clear signal that those that we rated more highly on ESG metrics outperformed through 2020 and indeed before 2020 as well. Now, there will be periods where that isn't the case. Well, I wouldn't think that will necessarily be the case in every point, in every sector, in every market. But we are starting to see a really compelling body of evidence build that ESG metrics help us establish better long-term investment returns. And so the first lens with therefore is, what is it that we do in the investment portfolios that we have? And how can we use engagement and robust engagement, if necessary, with the companies that we invest in to make sure that they take into consideration these factors as well, and that they have a plan that works to improve those metrics, to improve their long-run financial returns. We also have to apply the lens to ourselves. This gives us sympathy with the firms that we invest in, because, you know, I know from our own business, even trying to get our carbon footprint across the business is not easy. I know that it's not easy. We've turned the lens on ourselves and we're on the same journey ourselves that we are asking the firms we invest in to follow. So we're trying to hold ourselves to that same standard. We produced our first TCFD report just a few weeks ago. We've made our own commitment to net zero. So for us, there's two aspects to the ESG. There's how we use our influence in the companies that we invest in, and then how do we turn that lens on ourselves and make sure we are being truthful, we are being honest in what we're trying to push our own firm to do. We've got plans. We do some things quite well. There's other stuff we can definitely do better, and we're on that journey.
I was interested because we had an interview with Audrey Choi, who is Morgan Stanley's chief sustainability officer, and she made the point that when they looked at returns over the last, I think it was 3 and 5 year periods, it wasn't that those firms that were practicing ESG had significantly superior return numbers, but it was that their volatility was significantly lower, which was something I hadn't processed. But there are clearly two camps. There is the camp that says financial returns matter and therefore will work with companies like a BP and many others who are in transition. And there are those that are in the divestment camp. And I wonder how you think about that and what's the conversation you have with your managers?
Divestment is always an option, but if everyone immediately divests of the stuff that doesn't meet those criteria in the short term, all that happens is those shareholder registers get filled up with people actually who don't care. And we know we can't pretend that every investor rates ESG criteria at the same level. They clearly don't. So I think engagement, educated engagement, is far more likely to lead to rapidity of change than simply saying we're selling now because you don't meet certain criteria. And then who's applying the pressure to those businesses in order to get them to change? So, you know, for us, we're very much, yes, divestment is there. It's a last resort and there will be occasions where we use it, but it's far more powerful. And particularly if there are a coalition of investors with similar aims, it's far more powerful to work on accelerating the change, which is why we made our ESG metrics very forward-looking. We're looking for the delta. If you take a very dirty fossil fuel company and you make it meaningfully better, it might still not be perfect, but the delta that you've created in doing that probably has a far more meaningful change than a company actually that already has a very modest footprint and continues to do that just fine. So I think it is important that we think about the change. And the other aspect of this is how we manage the transition, because we have got to help the economies of the world that are less rich and are more dependent on some of the less clean fuel sources. You can't simply switch those off without providing economic and affordable alternative sources of energy. So thinking how you manage that transition in a fair and equitable way is really important. Otherwise, we're just going to squeeze the tube of the toothpaste and end up with the problem somewhere else. So I think engagement and thinking about the transition are really important, and they will get us faster to where we want to go than a straightforward divestment strategy, which I don't think will actually move things forward particularly.
In the last 20 years, there's been this big transition in the US, but also here in Europe, which is the reduction in the number of listed companies. I think the data is that in the US since 96, the number of US listed companies has halved, and institutional asset management in the UK was talking about a similar metric. Now, my question is twofold. Fidelity has been a research powerhouse. And does this actually give you an advantage because alongside that decline, there is a reduction in sell side research? Or is it actually something more concerning in terms of access to capital markets and the traditional mechanism by which the markets offered liquidity and therefore finance for companies? So I'm really asking two questions, I suppose.
First of all, the kind of private capital, public capital. And I think public markets were an utterly brilliant invention. The creation of the joint stock company, the creation of a way of distributing ownership of companies over a large part of the population was a brilliant, brilliant invention, that democratization of capital markets. And so I think that the first thing I would say is, I don't think we want to go back to a world where most capital is held in narrow, concentrated private hands. I think that's not where we want to be. I think there are some other trends which are interesting, which are not necessarily negative, but which you have to understand do affect a little bit some of this stuff. And what I mean by that is companies are staying private for longer, in part because they need to reach a higher level of maturity in business than perhaps they did 20 years ago. That's not necessarily a bad trend, but I think understanding why public markets are apparently becoming less appealing as sources of capital is something I think that we need to think about. And have we got too complex? Have we allowed too much of a disparity between private market and public market disclosures? And what are the regulatory things that sit around those? Has that become too complex? Has that become too different? That imbalance, I think, is something that regulators and exchanges need to look at. So that's the first thing that I would say. But I think having healthy private markets as well as healthy public markets is a good thing because they have different dynamics. And you mentioned volatility a little while ago. In the public market, volatility is unnerving for some people, and private markets obviously have less inherently because of their structures, have less of that day-to-day volatility, which is appealing to some people. When it comes to the fundamental research, actually, as an investor, as an investment management house, the research you do is not very different when you're researching private markets and public markets. And indeed, in the private space and fixed income space, sometimes public issuers are the issuers of private instruments. That happens as well. So I think it's not that one is good or one is bad, it's that you want balance and you don't want imbalance to come between the two. And you need to make sure that the rules and regs that surround private capital and public capital are fair and equitable and proportionate and reflect the differences in the underlying dynamics of the business and whose capital is being looked after.
And given that extraordinary growth in the private equity sphere, how have you tilted Fidelity's investment in approach and product range to reflect that appetite?
Our history and our focus has been until pretty recently, not quite exclusively on public markets, but much more oriented towards public markets. And I think what we're looking at now is how we can move a little bit more of our expertise into some of the areas which are adjacent to our historic powerhouse, which is our fantastic research base that we have. And so we've recently done a lift out of a private credit team, for example, who work very much alongside our existing credit research, but moving more into the private sphere. And we've got a small but growing and really excellent real estate business. So we would anticipate that organically, and perhaps with some very limited inorganic activity like team lift outs, that we will continue to build out that expertise in the private market as we go forward.
Fidelity has, of course, produced two of the greatest investment managers one knows of, Peter Lynch, whose book One Up on Moore Street is a must read for anybody who hasn't. But here in Europe, Anthony Bolton, whose special situations, I have the numbers between 1979 and 07, annualized at just under 20% versus the index at 13.5%. So £1,000 was turned into £147,000. One of the attributes of these great managers is the discipline. And therefore, I guess, how do you encourage your managers to be both disciplined and also not to be too emotional? Because the noise which surrounds us has intensified in the last decade.
Yeah, and Fidelity has got this fabulous culture. It's one of the things that is most inspiring about it, which is a really robust research base, a really robust risk framework that sits around all the fund managers with huge discipline. And then the confidence, the internal cultural confidence, having set those parameters to let fund managers find the place where they can do really, really well. So we try and give our fund managers as much latitude as is possible within the mandate for the money that they're looking after for other people, and within all, of course, the regulatory rules that sit around it. But culturally, we don't impose. We don't impose. We allow people to flourish as individuals within this very strong team cultural environment. And that's what helped Anthony flourish. But also Anthony then created, if you like, that ethos of what success can look and feel like. I've got to say, when I look across our 60-odd fund managers across Fidelity International, underpinned by well over 200 analysts, that's the equity fund managers, the 60-odd there, they're all different. You can't look at them and say they have this or that in common. We have extroverts, we have introverts, we have early morning risers, we have working very late in the evening, and they all reflect their own individual personalities. And that's one of the things that has been really refreshing about coming into Fidelity International. It has been that the vibrancy that sits, the curiosity that you see every day, that willing to be brave, but willingness to be bold in an investment sense. And it comes through in the numbers. It comes through in the results.
So you've worked for publicly listed asset managers and now a private asset manager. I think Fidelity is one of the top three asset managers in the world. How do you think about the merits of working for a privately owned company?
The advantage is that you do not have to report quarterly or 6 monthly with an eye always onto the regulatory reporting that you have to do to the exchange as a public company. And I sat on the Pru board when I was running M&G. I think probably a third or so of my time, even though I wasn't the chief executive of Prudential, I ran a subsidiary within that framework, but probably close to a third of my time, certainly a quarter of my time, was spent on directly or indirectly stuff that was related to the responsibilities of a public limited board. And I don't have to do anything like that level of, if you like, day-to-day finessing that you inevitably do when you're a publicly listed company. The downside, of course, is that we don't have access to capital markets in the same way. So we couldn't contemplate doing some of the huge headline acquisitions or M&A that you've seen some of our competitors do, because we just don't have access to public markets in that way. Sure, we can borrow, but we have to generate our own capital. There are trade-offs in it. I'm certainly loving being part of a private company, but then love being Aberdeen for 14 years as a public listed company with all the ups and downs, including the financial crisis. So both are great, but they just are a little bit different.
You've been very active as spokesperson for encouraging women to get into finance. I think you sit on women on boards, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you are doing and what you'd like to see and how this unfolds.
So I've been active and vocal in this space for many years. And I think one of the great things that I feel that we've seen over the last 10 years is I'm no longer the only woman in the room most of the time, which 10 years ago I was at a senior level. You've got Michelle Scrimgeour running LGIM, you've got Rachel Lord, of course, who was running EMEA for BlackRock and is shortly about to go over to APAC. You've got Hanneke Smits at, well, it was Newton and then Boney now. So we've definitely seen more women coming through to the top. And Carol Galley, who hired me originally at Mercury all those years ago, was probably the first trailblazer and was a delight to work for and with. So I think we've made real progress on that. I think what I would like to see from here is, you know, yes, we need more female chief executives. I really want to see more female fund managers. And if I have a fear, it is that the challenges of pandemic working from home have disproportionately fallen on working mothers or women who are caring for elderly parents or sometimes both. We've definitely seen that. You'll have read about it in the press as well. So we are constantly trying to figure out how can we make sure that the consequence of the pandemic is that we don't lose female investors, female fund managers, because I want to see more progress to become chief executives, more to progress to become CIOs, more to progress to become the Anthony Boltons of the future. And that would be the ambition. 30% Club continues to do fantastic work and still involved with Women on Boards UK, which are really focusing on the non-executive level. And we just need to keep pushing the message, keep trying to make sure that we understand where the impact is and trying to clear away some of those obstacles.
That's very important. And we've been lucky. We've had recently Tilly Franklin of Cambridge University. We've got Tracy Blackwell coming on of the Pension Insurance Corporation, Baroness Morrissey, and all of them, and many other leading females in finance. And I think that one of the messages that's come through is being a portfolio manager and being female actually dovetails really pretty well. So hopefully when we get through this ghastly period and we're all liberated again, we can see that longer term trend pick up again. I've got a few more general questions. I know you're involved in a few charities. You mentioned CERN, but tell me a little bit, I think CERN and Society, what it is that you're doing there.
So I've actually, in the middle of last year, I handed over my chairmanship, having helped set it up in, I think, 2014, 2015. The mission of CERN Society really is about trying to bring more of CERN's science mission to a wider population, because CERN as a research organisation obviously has nothing in its budget, really, in terms of taking its broader messaging out to a wider population. And I think if anything, the importance of science in the response to the pandemic has shown how important it is to have a science literate population at large, to have a science literate society. So it doesn't just do great science, which has spin-offs into medical and space and technology. The web obviously came out of the work that Tim originally did at CERN all those years ago. It's got these great spin-offs, and to just help people understand how fundamental research gradually translates over time through to marvelous technological medical advances in society at large, and just to help them make the connection. That's why fundamental research is so important for humankind as a whole.
So for our young listeners, and we have a lot who we're very grateful are listening to the show and thinking about their careers, what advice would you offer them?
I never knew what I wanted to do, particularly, mostly because I hadn't heard of most jobs. I didn't really know very many jobs that were out there. But what gradually emerged for me over time was I began to understand more and more. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I did know how I wanted to feel when I was doing something. So every job move I've done has been to take me closer to the things that I feel I enjoy. So to do more and more, to spend more and more of my day doing things that I enjoy. And I actually really enjoy being a chief executive. It's not for everybody, I get that. But I feel that I've managed to do that. So don't worry so much about what you want to be or what you want to do. Think about how you want to feel and just keep moving towards doing more and more of the things that make you feel good, that you make you enjoy the way that you're spending your time. That's one thing. The other little thing I would say, though, is when I look back, I worried about a lot of stuff. And I would really say to my younger self, worry less, really worry a lot less. Most of the stuff you worry about probably isn't going to happen. And so try and compartmentalize a little bit and try and just put that worry to one side. And I think that's advice I wish I had been given. You probably worry a bit too much, Anne.
Yours is an intense job. It's great that you enjoy it. But how do you deal with these pressures which build?
Well, you have to have a place that you can decompress. So you need to have a safe space with family, with friends that allow you to do that. And I mean, and I do some other stuff as well. I love being outside. So any excuse to be outside, I will be outside. I run a bit and I garden. So I have an allotment. I've had an allotment for 15 years, I think, and I grow vegetables. I joke about it, but it teaches you patience. You cannot hurry a carrot. The carrot's going to grow at the carrot's pace, and you learn to tend, to husband, to be patient, to go with the flow. And gardening is fantastic thinking time. Your mind is free to wander. Your hands are occupied. You're outside enjoying the fresh air. And your mind is free to wander. So it's great thinking time. I love that.
And post-COVID, apart from tending to your allotment, if you could invite two people from the world of investing to an event, be it sporting or cultural, who would you ask and what event would you choose?
I was thinking about this. So if you go back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was actually a really strong band of female stockbrokers. So I thought I would invite a couple of the female stockbrokers from the very end of the 19th century, Victoria Woodall and Mary Gage. Mary Gage founded her stockbroking business in 1880 in railroad and mining stocks because she found there was much inconvenience and annoyance in transacting with male brokers. So I would like to invite Victoria and Mary to an imaginary, to a fictional final of the US Tennis Open, where Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka are playing in the final, because I think that would be great fun for everybody.
I could be sure that nobody is going to come up with that if I ask that question again. That is terrific. Well, and I guess my final question to you is, if you could tell us just one thing.
Just one thing. Give it your best shot. Give it your best shot.
That's absolutely spot on in my books. So, Anne, you've given me lots of your time. I have learnt a lot. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I'm going to take two things away. One is around ESG. I've written this down. Educated engagement leads to more change. And I think that is missed sometimes. And although it may not sound it, as a light-hearted podcaster, worrying less. I would give that advice to my younger self, and I'd probably give it to other people around me. So there you go. Fantastic. Anne, thank you so much. That's just been super.
Well, thanks, Simon. I really enjoyed chatting to you. And good luck, and let's hope maybe one day we'll get to meet in person.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.